Welcome to Amici, news and insights from the New York Judiciary and the Unified Court System. Today we feature a small audio portion of a program presented in June by the Franklin H. Williams Judicial Commission. The commission, which promotes racial and ethnic fairness in the courts, hosted the 27th annual meeting of the National Consortium on Racial and Ethnic Fairness in the Courts. One of the speakers at the event in Buffalo was Professor Rachel Godsell, the Elmer Bontecue Professor of Law at Seton Hall. Professor Godsell is an expert in what is known as implicit bias and addressed judges and others at the conference for more than 2 hours. This podcast features only the beginning of Professor Godsell's presentation, just enough to provide a flavor for her address. However, the entire transcript is posted on the Court System website. We hope you find your remarks interesting and illuminating.
Thank you. It's an amazing honor to be here. I've had the incredible good fortune of working with Dr. Mickey Collins for approximately the last year or so, working with judges. And that has been truly in sort of an education and an honor. I start out as a lawyer. I was a civil rights lawyer for 25 years. I've been a teacher for 15 years. It's only in the last 8 years, which actually is quite a long time when I think about my kids' ages, that I started focusing on the mind sciences, and here's why. 25 years ago when I started in civil rights, there were a set of issues, and the one that ended up compelling and grabbing my heart most was environmental justice. This was an issue that in the late 1980s, when I was starting out as a lawyer, created the most tangible, visible example of what, as a kid who grew up in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, one of the most segregated cities in the country, with parents who cared deeply about civil rights, I saw every day, but no one could really explain. How could it be that the civil rights movement had happened, most people claimed that racism was wrong, most people genuinely believe that racism is wrong? There's an interesting poll done in Georgia in the early 2000s. 85% of white people from Georgia said they would not vote for a politician who was going to rescind discrimination laws. So most people, most whites all over the country, think that racism is wrong. And in fact, for most whites, to be considered racist is to be considered immoral, a bad person, un-American. It's considered worse than drunk driving, more immoral than drunk driving, second only to pedophilia. So how could it be, how was it in the late 1980s, and how is it now, that the vast majority of people find the idea of racism repugnant, and yet we continue to see the kinds of outcomes we see? People of color continue to experience what people of color continue to experience, and finally, much of that is now on the national stage as a result of cell phones. How are these two things explained? How is this paradox unlocked? And what the mind sciences can do for us is help us understand how two things can simultaneously be true. Whites and others can seriously, genuinely believe, not be hiding it because it's PC, but genuinely believe that being racism is wrong, and yet our behavior can be inconsistent with those ideals. Those two things can be true. And so what is really powerful about that, I think, and why it can be helpful in speaking to an audience of judges as well as an audience of educators or an audience of business people or any of the other audiences that I've spoken to since I started doing this work, is it's possible for us to talk about race without half of the group in the room, if it's an integrated room, to be lying. Because I think often when I talk to a group that has many people of color in it, understandably there's a response of like, sure. The white people are saying that they don't believe in racism, but that's not what they really think behind closed doors. And obviously, for some people, that's true. I mean, we all read the comments on the internet, and I think there's like some group of people who spend all of their time on the internet writing really offensive things. But my guess is no one here is spending all of their time on the internet writing offensive racist things. At least I'm hoping not. And so what the mind sciences do is they give us an explanation, a truly compelling, empirically, scientifically based explanation to help unlock this paradox. And what's even more exciting, and this is only in the last 2 years or so, we actually have some interventions. We have some actions that we can take to reduce bias And even more importantly, frankly, to reduce the behavioral effects of bias. Because let's be serious and let's be honest and say something we know. It's going to take a long time in this country to completely eliminate biases linked to race or ethnicity or gender. This is going to take a while. So it's unrealistic to think, let's just know we have some implicit bias and then, you know, sort of have an aha moment and suddenly it's gone. That's not going to happen. It's going to take work and it's going to take practice. But again, what's exciting is there's research to suggest that there are practices that we can engage in that will have the effect of reducing bias, and there's a great deal that can be done, particularly with powerful people like those in this room, to make sure that the effects of bias aren't manifested in the behavior. So this is a code of judicial conduct from Florida. As I mentioned, I've sort of traveled the country talking to different groups of state judges, and this is an example of a code of conduct that will be probably familiar to most of you. And clearly, for judges particularly, the idea of objectivity, of fairness, of making decisions that are based upon the evidence and the actions of the people before them is central to who a judge wants to be and thinks of themselves as. And the idea that as a judge, any of you or any of the judges I've spoken to would make a decision that was based upon an identity characteristic is horrific. And so when I've talked to groups that included family law judges, the idea that a judge would remove a child from a home because of racial stereotypes or biases against that child's parents or against that child, again, that makes a judge ill. The idea for a judge to think about, might I have sentenced a young person to a longer period in juvenile detention because of their race? That idea makes the judge ill. And so each judge thinks to themselves, and understandably so, I admit that this stuff might be happening elsewhere, but I know that I'm committed to being fair. I'm committed to following that code of judicial conduct, and I'm committed to objectivity. And so the question is, if the vast majority of judges and others in law enforcement, but again, I'm particularly focusing on judges, are committed to objectivity, does the research bear that out? Is the judiciary one area where we don't see the kinds of disparate outcomes we see in other contexts? I think all of you in this room will know that that's not true, that there is quite a bit, in fact, a wealth of evidence to suggest that race plays a role in decisions in judging, just like it frankly does in every domain of importance in our lives. So here's just a few examples of some research, and some of it is, all of it's disturbing. Some of the research suggests that race is playing out differently now than it did a couple of generations ago or a couple of decades ago. In some sense, race is no longer really a binary. It's not the box that you check as much now as it was at one time. So, for example, there has been research on sentencing that suggested we've made huge progress. Race no longer is notable in showing how different sentences emerge. Race is not a factor in the length of sentences that people get. And people are all excited. They feel very positive about the outcomes and the progress that's been made. But when the research is deeper and goes beyond the box that is checked, and Jennifer Eberhardt, who some of you may be familiar with her name, she won a MacArthur Genius Award recently for her work in this area. She's a social psychologist at Stanford. What she and a group of her graduate students did is, again, they went beyond the box and they looked at images and they looked at color and they looked at Afrocentricity of features. And when they went beyond the box and they looked at I think they're looking primarily at men with darker skin, men with more Afrocentric features, what they found were some serious disparities in sentencing. Because the judges aren't, you know, seeing a box and saying, oh, this is a black man, I must sentence him to longer. That's not what's happening. Instead, and this is where this idea of implicit bias, as I'll explain, comes into play, it's the unconscious visual imagery that causes the judge in some of these instances, and the research suggests probably many more than we'd like to think, it's the unconscious that causes the judge to look at the information in just a slightly different way. But as you all know, looking at information in a slightly different way, as that accumulates over different pieces of information, that can lead to some significant differences in outcome. And that's what the research shows. And the research shows, for example, that in cases involving capital punishment, there's this idea of looking death-worthy. If you are a very dark-skinned black man, you are more likely to be sentenced to death in a capital case. And again, not because anyone has the conscious thought, well, a very dark-skinned man obviously should be put to death. That's horrible. It's this unconscious response to a set of stereotypes that are more aggressively triggered when someone looks more like the group with whom they're associated. We were the Perception Institute, I should talk about that for 1 second before I go on. The Perception Institute is a consortium of social scientists, law professors, and advocates, and some judges, actually. We've worked with some judges. Judge Mark Bennett is someone you may have heard of from the District of Iowa who's done some wonderful work in this area. So this consortium was put together in 2008. Right in September, really, it began, September of 2008, which you may all remember was a pretty pivotal time in our country's history. So this was the period where it was not clear who would win the 2008 election. And this is not about being partisan. The concern that brought this group together was that there were a lot of sort of rumblings during that election about who is this man? I don't know what he stands for. This man, meaning Senator Barack Obama, who'd gotten more coverage in a primary campaign perhaps than any other candidate in history before, other than John F. Kennedy. But they were in Ohio and Pennsylvania and other places. I don't know that I don't trust him for some reason. Well, what might that reason be? So a group of social psychologists got together and started doing some research because the campaign didn't want to talk about race. And I understand that. They wanted race to be behind them after the Philadelphia speech. But these rumblings, these comments, were being addressed by surrogates for the candidate, but in very aggressive ways. So the governor of Ohio at the time was going around to union halls and saying to primarily white unions, you may not want to vote for a black man, but he's going to be better for the economy. And the members of the union would be, what? You're saying that I'm racist and I don't want to vote for him because he's black? That's not true. And immediately, 10 reasons for not voting for him would pop into their minds. Because no one wants to be called a racist. And if you call someone a racist and say, you know, you don't want to vote for him because he's black, but your pocketbook's going to be better off, that's not how people think. We're not the materialists in the way that sometimes political scientists assumed we are. So the social psychologist started looking into what could explain some of these phenomena when people were so offended by the idea that it was race alone, and this implicit bias came into play. So again, another set of research that's interesting. I'm not sure how many of you sort of, I don't think many states necessarily follow the Twombly-Iqbal pleading standards that the Supreme Court came down with a few years ago in the federal civil pleading standards. But what those pleading standards have done, as you probably know, is they've required significantly more information at the pleading stage than was previously the case in notice pleading. That has had no effect in contract cases whatsoever. But it has had quite an effect in employment discrimination cases. And the effect has been even greater in employment discrimination cases brought by black plaintiffs. Why might that be? Perhaps it's the subjectivity. Perhaps it's the lens. But let's see. Let's continue. So again, does this research and the wealth of other research that I could share with you mean that judges are racist? Some might want to use that word, and who am I? I have no moral authority to tell anyone what language to use. But what I would suggest is the research is powerful that most people, again, particularly people who are judges or who sit in positions of authority where objectivity is important, really reject the idea of race as a defining characteristic and think of racism as wrong. So while we can, you know, institutional racism is something that many of us are familiar with, but to call individuals racist is probably unlikely to advance a conversation and work about behavior, because frankly, it just makes people really defensive. No, I'm not. In my heart and in my head, I reject that. So if you want to have that debate with someone, you know, by all means. But what this research helps us do is to, again, understand that people can sort of be more than one thing, meaning they can really actually care about race issues and yet still have behavior and outcomes that are not consistent with those norms.
Thank you for listening to this edition of Amici. If you have a suggestion for a topic on Amici, call John Carr at 518-453-8669 or send him a note at jcaher@nycourts.gov. In the meantime, stay tuned.